This is the Muscles and Management Podcast, where we build your body and your business. Talking all things training, sports performance, and business for athletes and aspiring coaches to enhance your training and better your career. Muscles and Management is brought to you by Challenger Strength with your host, Jerry DeFilippo.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 38 of the Muscles and Management Podcast. As always, please subscribe, review, rate the episode. Guys, I can't tell you how much it helps and how much it means to me for those reviews, especially, you know, getting feedback and hearing that I'm having some kind of positive impact on an athlete, a coach, a parent, whoever it is, someone who's just into strength training in general. It means so much to me to get that feedback and know that people support the show. I see that every week in the growth and, you know, the improvement of the numbers and the listeners. So that, you know, it just goes to show it makes it worth it for me to put the work in for this show and to know that it's helping people and that people are a fan of it. It really means the world to me. Speaking of helping people, I have two awesome coaches coming on today, Daniel Flahey and Cody Hughes, two guys that are just phenomenal at what they do, two young coaches in the industry that are doing a lot of great work with the athletes and clientele that they work with. Excited to pair the two of them together. I think they have, you know, some interesting perspectives that will mesh well together. We both, you know, all three of us kind of have a lot of the same shared philosophies. And I do like when, you know, yes, I do like to have different philosophies from different people, not to, you know, always, you know, go down the same beaten path. But when I know that two coaches or another coach that comes on, you know, shares a lot of the same ideals that I do, I know that the conversation is going to be very beneficial to the listener because we're going to just flow and, you know, put things out there that mesh well together and ultimately, you know, give some, you know, practical, you know, applicable feedback to whether it's athletes, coaches, you know, parents listening. Cause at the end of the day, you know, I want everyone to come away from each episode of this with something that they can do, and apply to, you know, whatever they're doing with training or wherever they are, you know, in sports or whatever it is. So, I'm excited to have them on. I think you guys are really going to enjoy our discussion. We're talking, you know, what actual sports specificity is when it comes to training, you know, the importance of having a philosophy-based and principle-based approach to programming, you know, and not being superficial and exercise-based. Talking a little bit about lifting beyond the numbers, you know, the three of us have had experience in realizing that, you know, one rep max, you know, numbers aren't the be-all end-all of improving athletes and improving clients in terms of their training, how we've, you know, gone about still using strength work. We're very big on, you know, getting people stronger, getting athletes stronger, but making sure that it's conducive to the sport and getting the athletes better at specific things, whether it's speed, you know, lower body power, things that are going to contribute to the athlete itself, and how we've kind of made a little bit of a shift in our philosophies. In that sense, we're talking Verkhoshansky, the principle of dynamic correspondence, you know, making training transferable to sport in the certain areas that you need to hit to get to that point. You know, we're talking a little bit about giving parents and, you know, athletes proper knowledge of strength training to make sure that they understand the why behind what they're doing and how it's improving them. You know, and we're going to wrap it up a little bit with, you know, the blending or bridging the gap of, you know, anecdotal experience-based evidence and research, why both are important, how you can work them together, and ultimately what we've all learned, you know, to get better as coaches and to show you that, you know, getting better every day and you're not being perfect is okay too. Excited to have them on. I think you guys are going to enjoy it. Until next time I talk to you guys, enjoy this interview. Peace. All right, everyone. I'd like to welcome on Daniel Flahey and Cody Hughes. Guys, thanks so much for coming on. I really appreciate your time.
Hey, thanks for having us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, appreciate it, man. Looking forward to it.
Absolutely. For those of you who don't know, I've, you know, been connected with Dan and, Cody on Twitter for a while. I just love some of the stuff they're putting out, the work they do with their respective clients and athletes. You know, I really thought the two of them would be great to pair together. I like to have guests, come on together sometimes, really open up, you know, multiple person discussion. You know, I think they have a lot to offer when it comes to, you know, obviously you're going to see a lot of the topics we talk about today, but, I really enjoy their content and I'm happy to have them on. One of the first things that I wanted to talk to both of you about, and I first opened this to you guys in terms of what you wanted to discuss on the show, but I wanted to speak to both of you. Cody brought up a great topic about, you know, lifting beyond the numbers, talking beyond one rep maxes in the weight room and, you know, why it's not the, you know, be all end all for athletes. Cody, I'm going to let you open with that since you suggested that as a topic and I really liked it. You know, if you want to kind of start up with, you know, your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I'm gonna give a little bit of background on that. You know, coming out as a college athlete, you know, I fell in love with the weight room and I saw success with the weight room, but I didn't really know a lot. You know, I was really green, but as I became a strength coach and segued from player into coach, you know, I was obsessed with numbers, man, at the beginning. You know, I was like, strength is everything. We need to be pushing weight. And it wasn't until just really this past year and a half or so as I've segued and now that I'm in the high school setting of understanding what strength means. You know, I have a new definition for what strength means. I used to think that strength was purely what you could put through a barbell, you know, and what I want everybody to know is, especially for the listeners, anybody that's listening, like understand that if that strength can be expressed in a whole lot of different ways than just through a barbell. It's the same, like it all depends on leverage, mechanics, and what you're looking for and what the story is telling. It's like for me and my programs, we can talk a little bit about my system. We don't back squat in my system at the high school level at all. We only front squat. And there's a lot of reasons to that, and we can get into that later. But, you know, my best front squatter is probably front squatting 335, and he was a college football guy that's signed to go play college football. Well, your program may have 10 guys that squat 400. Does that necessarily mean your guy's stronger than mine? No, not necessarily, right? Yep. So that's what I'm trying to get into is, like, where is strength, right? When we talk about strength in numbers, the numbers matter. I think the numbers absolutely matter. But in what ways? What information are we using with that to help with, one, driving performance? I know me and Daniel love this phrase of health drives performance. We say it often on Twitter. Mm-hmm. It's my philosophy that I drive by. But what is strength doing and what does it matter in the big picture to help our guys stay healthy and then perform on the field?
Yeah, I think that's really well said. Dan, I want to let you add to that too, but before we get to that, I just want to throw something in there. Maybe it'll spark a little bit of the conversation. A couple episodes ago, I had Max Schmarzo on, Strong by Science, and he put this in a way that really changed my whole outlook on everything. I had just posted a video. It got a lot of, you know, some positive feedback, some negative from some old school guys about, you know, being quote unquote strong enough. And, you know, he brought up a really good way to think about it in terms of being strong enough in the context of your sport. Like that, it's impossible. You always want to be stronger within the context of your sport, but what is that context? And finding that out is really key. With that said, Dan, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, being strong is important, right? But like Cody said, what does that really mean? Mm-hmm. And you know what you said with the front squatters, if you have a heavy front squat, you're going to transfer that to a back squat. But the same's not true from a back squat to a front squat. And I've moved away from back squats a little bit as well. And I might get chastised for this, but I don't do one rep max testing at all anymore. Yep. With me my either. Athletes.
Hey, I don't either. Yeah, we can talk about that. It's not a thing for me either, Dan.
Yeah, you know, I played around with three rep maxes even. But now this year, and I always change my methods. I think I keep my principles few, but my methods many. And we've gone to a kind of an RPE based ratings of perceived exertion system this year.
Okay.
Which kind of works with the, you know, velocity based training and all that. So, you know, I want them to move heavier weight, but you know, if they're not feeling it that day, then we're not going to do the prescribed 75% one rep max or 80% stuff like I used to do. So I don't do percentage based training at all, really anymore. So I've moved far away from the one rep max stuff.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, I agree. Couldn't agree more. I have moved in the similar path myself. You know, really feeling that one, you know, especially with a new athlete, how do I know, you know, what their experience is with a particular lift? You know, worrying about, you know, are the mechanics there? Are they able to handle the load? If you're going for a one rep max, obviously you're going to be pushing loads up to, you know, the limit of what an athlete can handle. And if you have no experience with a new athlete, knowing what that is for them or how they're going to respond to that, it can get pretty dangerous. You know, and even along the lines of saying, you know, the first thought I had to myself was, oh, if we're not going to do a one rep max, like how do, you know, I measure improvement? Understanding that, like, that number wasn't going to be a huge gauge for me in terms of improving an athlete. It was going to be more of a thing that I used to, you know, improve metrics such as a vertical jump or a broad jump or a 10-yard sprint time. I was going to use those and depend on those to measure effectiveness of programming and not the, you know, heavy one rep max measurement in the testing itself. Like, you know, I don't know if you guys agree with that or that thought process, or how do you feel about that?
Well, I think that's a great point. Sorry, Dan, I didn't mean to cut you off, but,
no, go ahead.
You know, that's a great point. Think about it. I work with 8th graders, 9th graders, 10th graders every single day that have horrible movement patterns, right? They sit in desks all day. Kids can't move. I mean, that's basically what we're trying to do. And I was in that spot at one point in my career, Jerry, where I was at, you know, the first thing I wanted to do, I've done it. Like, I've done the very first thing I did when I stepped in as a GA was max the kids. And that was a huge mistake, thinking that, oh, well, I can't train these athletes if I can't prescribe percentages. That's a very shallow way of thinking, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Because what is that number when you start with them going to mean anyway? Like, what does that number mean? Like, is their technique's not there, their movement's not there. That number that they're expressing, that strength they're expressing through the movement, really, which is probably dysfunctional anyway, what does that even mean towards improvement? Because at the end of the day, what's probably going to happen, what I notice, is that the kids come in fresh, they want to crush it, their numbers probably look pretty good, and then they're going to be really sore in week three, their numbers are probably going to look terrible. And plus, if you continue to try to just push load, push load, push load, push load, you're just continuing loading a faulty movement pattern. It's just going to create problems. When you can deceive yourself and tell yourself that you're actually improving just because numbers are going up. When I think a lot of coaches do that to themselves and create that and say, hey, just because we see strength numbers going up, but what does that mean? It's got to tell way more of a story than just what a number says on an Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah, right. For sure.
So, I've grown the most, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's all about context too. Like, I have a powerlifting client. So of course we do percentage based, you know, off of one rep max testing because her goal is to lift as heavy weight as possible for one single rep.
Yep.
But in terms of athletes, you know, that's not our goal. Our goal is to make them better at their sport, not freaks in the weight room.
Dan, do you not use percentages at all with your athletes over at Mount Marty?
Not this year. Again, like I say, I play back and forth. I did percentage stuff last year and we did have success with it. Last year I did it off of a 3 rep max, I believe. But we're doing just RPE stuff right now. But a lot of my girls, so I work with the women's basketball team, and they don't have, a lot of them didn't have as good of a strength coach in high school like you are. So we're just getting movements down correctly right now. So we're just, you know, we're all doing goblet squats with them. My track team, only a couple people are doing, back squats and front squats. Everybody else is still just doing goblet squats at this point right now, even.
Cool. The reason I ask is because I've come across, you know, I've done my share of really trying to push continuing education the past, I'd say, 2 years of my career. And I end up hiring a guy, I'm going to call him out. His name's Angelo James. He's one of the smartest guys I ever met. It's actually a guy I replaced at my high school. It's pretty cool. He helped, you know, I hired him to kind of talk a little bit about what my metrics meant. And he's been somewhat of a mentor to me. But I was going to tell you, Jerry, I actually use three, whenever I train my athletes, I use three metrics. I use how much weight they've moved, how many reps they've done, and I also use an RPE scale from 1 to 10. I define that RPE scale. I use those three metrics, and it spits out a training max for me based off of, you know, if I have a kid that can front squat 135 for 5, and he tells me that it was a 6 out of 10, right, his training max is going to be higher if the kid down here did it well but said, no, that was like a 9.
Yeah.
And I define those. I have those three metrics. I put it into a formula. It spits out a training max. I record those weekly, and I can see training maxes weekly over a long period of time and see if I can see trends going upward. But I want to make sure I preface that we always make sure I put it on Twitter, probably, I don't know if it was about a month ago, of my training hierarchy is what I like to call it, to make sure that we can train through the full range of motion and be able to control that range of motion before I even worry about those metrics. So I think that's cool. You know, I think RPE is super important. I think you can change the game because especially with kids, with me, they don't know how hard they can push really. Because a lot of them are nervous, especially females. Females don't want to, they're scared to hurt. You guys want to go really hard because their ego is speaking to them. You know, their kids are trying to prove something, and sometimes they'll go too fast. They'll try to go too far, and they'll cut things away from movement quality just to see a bigger number because, you know, that's the one thing my athletes like to come in. Hey, coach, how much you bench?
Yeah.
You know, how much you bench, coach? Like, I'm like, well, it's a little deeper than that, bud. So.
For sure. Something – I love that idea. I want to talk more about that in a little bit, about like how you're using those three metrics to kind of come together and give a bigger picture or such better idea and more you know, deep idea of what the actual max is for each athlete. And I think the RPE is huge because, you know, the 135 for, you know, athlete A isn't going to be the same, you know, exertion rate for as athlete B, and it's going to have a role in what the max is for that particular athlete. Kind of piggybacking off of, you know, what I mentioned and what I referred to from what Max said on a couple episodes ago. What really changed my whole perspective on this entire thing was I used to try to treat this, you know, squat or deadlift or whatever it was as an actual metric I was trying to improve in testing. And while, you know, it is nice to see those numbers go up, especially when there's a, you know, really novice athlete, when the number going up, you can almost guarantee that number going up is going to improve everything else that you're trying to improve. Not really looking for that, you know, improvement in the one rep max or three rep max or five rep max as much as like, is that number coinciding with an increase in a more important metric for me, maybe like a vertical or a 10-yard sprint. And I'm right with you guys in the sense that I moved away from doing that type of stuff because I just felt like the more I've trained people and the more I've learned that it was less important on those metrics that were more important in what I felt to the sport. Something that I look to kind of guide me in that sense, and I'm going to kind of open the floor for your thoughts on this, but I've talked a lot about on Twitter about Verkhoshansky and the principle of dynamic correspondence in a more simple sense, transferability, right? How much does your training transfer to the sport that you're playing? A couple things he lists off are intensity, duration, the planes of motion you're training, the frequency, or the speed of that, of the movement you're using, muscle groups, things like that. How does, you know, thought processes like that kind of guide you guys in terms of how you program for your athletes or your just regular clientele?
Yeah. So, maybe it was Cody that put a little while ago that, it's not dehydration that's cramping your athletes. It's the lack of intensity. Mm-hmm. And you know, I fully believe that. We always say you got to practice like you play, but that's kind of just a phrase we throw out there. What does that really mean? It means we have to have a certain level of intensity, that transfers to competition.
Yep.
And you know, plane of motion stuff, huge. I am the first to admit I neglected planes of motion for a large part of my early years training people. I was so sagittal plane focused, you know, squats, deadlifts, that kind of stuff. And I forgot that, oh yeah, there's frontal plane, transverse plane, and actual planes of movement in sport is multi-planar in all facets. So we have to be training all those three planes of motion. So like with the girls basketball team, their previous trainer didn't do really anything frontal plane, lateral movements at all. So we've started out very light doing, you know, slide board, side lunges and that kind of stuff. And they were extremely sore the first week, even though we kept super volume, just they've never even done, you know, adductor kind of inside leg work before, which is super important for, you know, basketball because you're moving laterally all the time. So I think it's not just squat numbers and deadlift numbers and that sagittal plane. We have to think about all of that plane of motion. And you say frequency and speed. So I found two really old school kind of Tendo units that were just collecting dust in my school. So I broke those out. I had my work study do a bunch of deadlifts today to test them out. So I'm going to start breaking those out a little bit too, I think, and working more on the quality of the movement of the bars, you know, how fast and crisp they're moving, not how much weight's on there, so to speak.
Yeah, for sure. Cody, what do you think about that?
Yeah, man, I think that that's the principle of dynamic correspondence is 100% has to be priority. I mean, unfortunately, I see a lot of strength coaches in this game, especially, you know, young ones. I myself was this guy that got so caught up in the meathead game and was like, we're going to train big, we're going to lift big. And it's almost like you made it into your own thing and took away from the thing they actually love. Because, like, guys, athletes for the most part, except for us, because, you know, we're crazy, don't love to lift. Yeah. You know, they don't love to get in there and bang the weight, man. I did. That's why I became a strength coach. I know a lot of athletes that are very talented. They hate it, but they know they have to do it in order to, you know, to develop. So if we're doing something that can show them, hey, this is how this is going to transfer, you're probably going to get a little more belief. And man, that's half the battle. If you can get your kids to believe that what we're doing is helping them get where they want to go, that's going to help results anyway. But as far as my programming standpoint goes, I try to stay holistic, man. You know, I don't have a very specific niche like you do, Jerry, where, you know, you're mostly training baseball and hockey guys, you know, same thing for you, Dan, you know, you've got track and field, you got women's basketball. I get kids that can be a regular student, a ninth grade regular student's never seen a barbell, or my 12th grade senior left tackle who signed to Eastern Kentucky last year, all in the same class. I've got to be very, very creative of how I program, and I run a multi-stage level from a novice, intermediate to advanced, and I have standards of how of where you fit inside of those.
Yeah.
And for me, I stick to a very basic movement principle-based program to make sure I hit everything. So for in my program, in my system at least, I like to Olympic lift, right? A lot of this, but if I was training baseball guys, which I did at McNeese State when I was the assistant director, I didn't Olympic lift at all because I don't think that the transferability was really there. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, you were talking about it on a past episode, Jerry, about how some guys love Olympic lifts. Some guys get really anal about whether you do them or not. Well, I just think it's just a tool you need to have. You need to be able to teach it, you know, to whenever it's applicable. So we clean. I like to clean in high school because, one, you can't out-muscle it. It takes commitment and process to be able to get good at it, right? And then when they do get good at it, it makes them feel cool, man. Confidence. It's a thing that the kids love to do whenever their clean looks good. So we always make sure we hit a squat. We always make sure we hit some type of single leg work. I like to, at least as far as my language goes in my system, it's either a lunge or a split squat. Okay, so split squats where, you know, we're in a split position, whether it be rear foot elevated, front foot elevated, both feet on the floor, feet stay static, and when you move, and then lunge is where one foot comes up, whether it be lateral, whether it be reverse, front, however you want it. So I make sure I hit both of those, right, both those types of single legs. I make sure I hit the posterior chain, both knee dominant, hip dominant. Make sure I hit I try to hit speed as well, because one thing I'm moving to this year, I'm actually a huge fan of Tony Holler and his Feed the Cats program. I'm actually working on getting a G sprint from Max and those guys. I talked to Jerry. I talked to you a little bit about that. I want to start laser timing because I've timed probably over 300 to 400 10 yard sprints already in my first 5 weeks of training. And that's given me a lot of really cool data. So after we warm up my kids, we run two high intense 10 yard sprints. I collect the data, look at it over time, make sure we're hitting that speed part. On Fridays, we go out to the track. We do some max speed work and some top speed work, very low volume. And then we on Fridays, we try to come in and do a lot of mobility work with that as well. So, you know, my same thing with the upper body stuff. I try to make sure I hit a horizontal press and pull, make sure I hit a vertical press and pull. I just try to make sure I encompass every single one of my movement categories.
Yep.
And then follow my hierarchy. Do we know what we're doing? Do we know how to move? Can we move well? Can we move under control? Then can we load it? And then can we express force fast with that load? That's those five steps, man. That's all I do. And then I just rotate all of my accessory stuff as far as scapular work, band pull aparts, core work, you know, my adductor work. I try to make sure I rotate those in because all of my athletes or students, because not all of them are athletes, are on the same program. It's just a matter of where they're progressed, regressed, just because of their training age and their ability. So that's where I'm at. I'm 100% with that. Man, but I'm going to tell everybody, like, I want you guys to know I was that guy that didn't care about that stupid principle about dynamic correspondence. I didn't care. I was like, we're going to squat the house. But mostly because that was because of my insecurity as a coach. Because I didn't know they have answers of did it transfer.
Yeah.
You know, I was still doing suicides and running 120s and being the loud screaming guy. I was that guy, man. So I don't want you guys to think that, you know, I know it all. I'm not even close. I just want to know that I made a lot of mistakes before I figured out that I'm not going in the right direction.
Right, and it's a process, man. And I agree. That's how I program my programs too. You know, hip dominant, knee dominant, push pull, vertical, horizontal, all that stuff. I mean, that's all you really need. It's super simple, but it's super effective. And you know, like you said, I'm gonna make probably a million more mistakes the rest of my life, but that's part of the process. So,
well, I got to be super creative too, because like for example, our girls basketball team is super good. They've gone to the state championship past 2 years in a row. We've got three D1 signees. They come at me because they have conditioning in the mornings. We're a small school, guys. We share athletes like crazy. I'm still working on having conversations with coaches who run conditioning sessions because, you know, I can't hit everybody. I'm by myself. But they kind of do their own thing anyway because, you know, coaches don't know what they don't know, and that's okay. Well, they come into squat, and they're like, Coach, we ran – I can't tell you how many long sprints we ran. And I was like, how long is your sprint? And they said, 1 minute. And I was like, well, that's not really a sprint, you know. Like,
yeah, if they're measuring it by time, then they're right. They're off right away. Yeah. It's an easy way to tell.
They're running for like we're running for 120 seconds at a time, and we got to do this, and then we ran, you know, in these stands all this time, and then all of a sudden, one of my girls said the coach looked at us and was like, "Wow, what's wrong with y'all? Y'all are looking slower." And I was like, "Huh? Well,
yeah, I wonder why."
We're gonna have to have that conversation one day, but so I have to understand that, like, I try to look at least and see what they're doing the other 23 hours before they come into my weight room for 1 hour or an hour and a half. Because remember, what I preach all the time is health. If I just lift what's prescribed for that day and I know that they're not ready for it, like, that's not doing them any good. That's just pushing my ego. So I have to make sure I can back off on that. So that's one of the harder things for me too, as far as being able to program and understanding what's best for them and getting to transfer is one. I think these kids are playing so much AAU, so much travel ball, so much going to, you know, external trainers, external hitting coaches. Like, they're so run down. I'm like, dude, I try to be a very, very minimal effective dose guy. Like, I want to get really good, but we're not going to push a whole lot of volume in here because I think eventually the returns are going to be diminishing.
Well, I mean, that speaks, you know, again, a lot of things I talked about on the episode with Max, and I reference him a lot because he's in my mind an absolute genius. I mean, he'll tell me I'm dumb for saying that, but he is, in my opinion. He just, the way he described the idea of, like, we always talk about metrics and like how we're measuring the effectiveness of programming, and like you said, minimal effective dose. If my metrics can help me weed out, you know, what's the most effective in my programming then becomes efficient. And that's our goal, is to one, make it effective, find out what does work, and then two, find out how little of that we actually need to get the results we're looking for. And then we have an optimal and efficient program, right?
Absolutely. Dan, like, I remember we were talking about programming a little bit, and you're talking about RPE and how if you tried to one rep max, like, you, that's the only way you're going to see progress is if you do that, right? Well, we got to understand too, is that not all data is quantitative. It's qualitative as well. When you look and see how somebody moves, you don't necessarily put a number to that. That's part of you being a coach, right? But that's improvement too. And if you've got those standards of how you move and have certain motor control and things like that, it might not necessarily be a number. So when we see progress, like, understand there's two types of data there. I'm not a researcher. I know Dan's a PhD candidate. He can probably talk way more into that, the academia side. But I know that not all data is going to come with a number. So when we see progress, we can't necessarily put our hands on it. You know what I mean? Like, I guess I'm kind of digressing here, but trying to lead into that point.
Absolutely. You know, if you want to even go any farther than that too, it's mental state too. Like, are the athletes in a better mood? Are they happy? Are they, you know, enjoying life when they leave the weight room? Because if they're beat down every single time, that doesn't do a lot of good either, right? We need to facilitate a positive environment for the kids. And I agree with that. I love Tony Holler's Feed the Cats, right? Because it's fun in his program. And that should be fun also. Like, it shouldn't be torture to go in the weight room and just get beat down every single day. So there's qualitative metrics on that side too.
Yeah, no doubt. Culture, man. Culture. I'm sure, Jerry, you can talk about it all day. It's like, you want your kids to come in and be jacked to be around you as a coach, right? And who we are as people. Like, can they be jacked up? Because that's part of it. If we can win that psyche, if we can win the person first, like, you know, I was asked, like, what's the best coaching advice I ever received? It was coach the person, not the athlete, right? If we can win them as people, I think that's the first step of seeing great metrics outside. I mean, look, we can be great programmers, but if we suck as people, guys, we ain't never going to get these kids better.
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, it just kind of ties into the idea of, you mentioned this earlier, making sure that we have ways to show the athlete or the, you know, even if it's like a regular student, you know, they want something that you have to kind of try to find, you know, however best you can, what the end goal for them is or what they're trying to get to. Because like you said, you know, getting them jacked up to show up is, they need to know that when they get there every day and they put that work in, that like what they're doing is getting them to whatever goal they're trying to get to. Right.
Right. And we have to be able to clearly tell them whatever's in a program. If they ask us why it's in here, we need to tell them exactly what it's for and why it's in there. Cause if it's not, you need to reassess your program. And that, what you guys are talking about with the athlete transfer, I mean, that works for the Gen Pop population too. Like, outside of the athletes, I train a lot of 55 and older clients. What do they want to do? They want to move around better, play with their grandkids, that kind of stuff. So if we can show them, hey, if you load a little bit on a deadlift, everything you do when you pick up stuff off the ground is a deadlift. This is going to help you pick up your grandkid better in less pain. Like, that stuff is super important for everybody. And like, you probably related some stuff to the kids that aren't athletes, Cody, on how this stuff can benefit whatever they like to do outside of the weight room.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a great point, Dan. I mean, I had a kid that came into, this is a huge point that I felt like that told me I was doing something right, was last year I had a kid that came in, you know, and where I'm at as far as PE goes, you're only required to take the class until ninth grade. After ninth grade, it becomes an elective and it comes more of athletic enhancement for my class. So if you're taking it as an elective, you know, you don't have to take it anymore. Well, there was this kid named Matt that came to me after his ninth grade year and said, "Coach, I'm taking your class every year. I love it. Like, I've seen muscles in the mirror. I feel more confident. Like, I love to train, man." I was like, dude, this is awesome.
Yeah, it's the best feeling.
This has got me jacked up, right? This is what it's about, you know? So you hit the nail on the head there, Dan.
Yeah, no, I had a kid even say to me, he's an athlete too, but he was like, you know, my pants are tighter. I ripped a pair of my work pants the other day. And he was like a very thin kid coming into me. So like, seeing that confidence in him, I've talked about the tight jersey theory before and how, you know, yes, we're going to sit here and talk a lot. Where, you know, we're people that work with athletes, and we're going to talk a lot about, you know, improving sports performance. But, you know, I don't think any of us would say that it's not important to increase confidence, you know, via an athlete having more muscle and making sure that obviously it's got to go towards the sport and get them better. But there's a lot to be said for just throwing that jersey on after the offseason and be like, man, I feel bigger. I feel stronger. It's going to make them, you know, more confident in their sport or in life in general, even if they're just a student.
Yeah, man. I want to make sure I quote him right. I believe it was Joe Ken that said the number one transferable quality from the weight room to the field is confidence. Yep. I think he coined that. And, you know, every once in a while, man, you got to let them blow up on some bicep curls and some,
yeah.
You know, and get them big, man, get them swole to feel good. Now you time it right. You know, it's probably not a greatest idea to do that the day of a bullpen, Jerry, right? I mean, I was a college baseball player, so I know that.
Yeah.
I made that mistake. I said, oh, we're going to get big today. And then our guys had bullpens that day, and my baseball coach came to me and said, what were you thinking? And I was like, yeah, I screwed that one up, coach. My bad.
Yeah. Oh, I've been there, man. It's baseball player. It's tough. Like, you get so wrapped up in not having confidence as a coach at some point where you're like, I just want to make sure I don't hurt these guys in the sense that they're so temperamental, especially pitchers, like fearing that what you're going to do is going to make them worse. Like it's really easy to make them worse, and it's hard to make the higher level guys better. You know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely. I understand exactly what you mean.
You know, it's kind of segueing. We've already touched on a lot of this in terms of you mentioning, you know, how you program both of you, and I'm in the same boat as, you know, building things off movement patterns and, you know, having philosophies that guide us. We talked a little bit about the principle of dynamic correspondence, transferability in terms of, you know, assessing whether or not training is, you know, really working towards a sport we're preparing our athletes for. And even in the sense of general, you know, population clients, making sure we're prepping them for whatever they're trying to get to. Talking a little bit about programming and, you know, not having an exercise-based approach that is, you know, you're married to a certain exercise, a certain way of doing things, and having, you know, more principles and philosophies that, you know, are the skeleton and the base of our programming that we just, you know, adapt and tweak and adjust. Dan, I'm going to open the floor to you on this one. You know, what are some of the pitfalls of an exercise-based approach and, you know, trying not to program superficially and having more philosophies and principles that you build your programming on? Like, what does that mean to you, and how do you, you know, try to implement that?
Yeah, you know, so many people get caught up, like you said, in, you know, the back squat is the king of all exercises or whatever, you know. And there's, in my mind, there's nothing really wrong with the back squat, but there's many different ways we can get to that same movement pattern, right?
Yep.
Goblet squats, front squats, you know, whatever. I use box squats sometimes. I know people like will bury me for that, but I do use box squats sometimes. Right?
I use them
not the West Side barbell, like sit down and all that kind of stuff, but we do touch and go box squats and that kind of stuff.
Let me just ask you something real quick. Do you use it more as a gauge of like depth for the guys or the girls, whoever you're training?
So sometimes, but I found was really nice last year with track and field. I did, it was probably an 18 inch, even maybe a little higher box. And we went super light, like 2 days before meets. We went, you know, the guys were doing 135 on the back squats. The ladies were doing like 75 pounds.
Okay.
And it was just really explosive movements. And they seemed to really, really like that because it made them feel fresher on the day of the meet.
So more of the like the top half of the range of motion, if it's a little bit higher, you're saying?
Right, right.
Okay.
Which, you know, I might get chastised for that too. And I'm not saying we shouldn't,
you shouldn't be,
you know, all off season. Yeah. We're usually doing full range of motion squats, but sometimes I think that's okay to put into a program. But if you get so set on, you know, ass to grass back squat, that's the only way you can go, then you kind of lose sight of the bigger picture of developing, like Cody said, a holistic athlete, right? There's a time and place for a lot of things in a program.
You hit the nail on the head there. And that was a great example. Like, having that superficial approach would be married to the idea that everyone must squat ass to grass no matter what time of year it is, what you're doing. Or the other side of the coin was, oh, like it's okay to do, you know, more top range of motion stuff where we only do isometrics in like positions where I'll give you an example. I had a guy the other day, I'm prepping him for a workout he has with a pro team, you know, doing isometrics in like that top half of the, or even like the top quarter of the range of motion, you know, before a sprint, right? Like there are times and places for that. And when you do things more on a philosophy-based approach, like you said, and you had a great example, you know, you're going to know when it's okay to do that squat and more of the top half of range of motion and when you need to be, you know, in more of a conventional position. And, you know, it can be dangerous to, you know, be married to one side or the other, no matter what.
And I'm not at all saying you should load up the bar to 425.
Oh, yeah, no,
quarter squat. Yeah. Like you see those videos. That's not what we're talking about at all.
That's just a person who's
terrible
just
training.
Yeah. That's just a person who's just like butchering an exercise. Like they don't know any better. You're referring to, right. You know, and I'm happy you kind of covered yourself there. Cause some people be like, oh, what do you mean? You could do a quarter squat. Like if it's done the right way, there's been a lot of benefits that, you know, have been shown to, you know, improve speed and sprinting and a lot of track coaches, you know, you being one yourself in terms of training track athletes have utilized it effectively. Cody, what do you feel like? How do you feel about that?
The biggest thing that I feel like, because in my niche, you know, you see a lot of sport coaches that run the weight room.
Yep.
Right. We have to understand that we're training qualities, guys. We're not training the quarter squat to be good at the quarter squat. That's what a lot of people think, like, oh, you're cheating. You're cheating the squat because you're not going all the way down just to get more weight. Well, it all depends on perspective and context, man.
Yes.
And what quality are you training? If we're not training qualities, what are we doing? Like, it's a complete waste of time. That's where I think that a lot of people miss the boat is that, guys, we use a mix of really four sports to get somebody better at another sport, right? Bodybuilding, powerlifting, Olympic lifting, track and field to be good at baseball or basketball or whatever, right? We're using a mix of those principles, but we're not trying to get them better at the back squat for the sake of being better at the back squat.
Yeah.
We're trying to transfer over. That's the biggest thing that I feel like coaches miss. They're like, coach, we got to get in the weight room. We got to get stronger. We're not strong. I'm like, well, what do you mean? What does that mean? Right? I even like Tony Holler. They say, we need to get bigger, faster, and stronger. And Tony Holler always says, well, in what order? Because not all happening at once, dude. Like, what do you mean by strong? Because sometimes coaches will say one thing, but they mean something else. And that's one thing about strength coaches is you want to talk about adaptability, which I may be getting off topic here, is when you're communicating with other coaches, you got to learn how to speak their language to understand what they really mean, because they dang sure can't speak our language. And if you get around,
you had a tweet that was really good about that, actually, that I remember. And someone was trying to argue with you that it's not important to know the differences in a clean versus like a power clean. And, you know, people mistaking a power clean, meaning it's moving fast.
Yeah. I mean, it's, that's true. And I feel bad. I get a little harsh on Twitter, guys. I go off on dudes.
No,
I
you do? Do you?
Because I do. And that's okay. And the reason why I touched on that is because, like, language matters.
Yeah. No, I thought it was a great tweet at the time. I was like, it's very important.
Yeah. Like, if you can communicate what the intent and what the quality is, your language needs to back that up.
Yes.
And it doesn't have to be the same, guys. Like, just because I call it something, like one of my mentors, Riley Allen, who's at Ole Miss basketball, like, we talk about this all the time. Just because I call it a Paloff press, he says, I call it a band press because my basketball guys don't give a crap about who Paloff is.
I had a kid ask me that today. Why? Who is Paloff? Why is it called Paloff press?
Exactly. So he's like, I just call it band press so they understand it better. And I'm like, well, that's the mastery of language. That's where it fits in to be able to understand. Because especially I'm working with 16 and 15-year-old guys. I got to be simple. Like, very simple words. The words mean something. It even – every little word, it will talk about position. It will talk about intent. And then we can talk about transferability. I don't ever talk about weight. And I actually have to fight that because, you know, I have a problem. I had a kid get hurt last year because he saw his buddy trap bar deadlifting next to him. And he's like, oh, I bet I can do that.
Oh,
and
man.
I was working with another kid. And he comes over there and tries to pull it and hurts his back.
Yeah.
And they're like, it's your fault, coach. Oh, you the weight room hurt him. I said, no, your kid not following directions got hurt.
Yes. Yeah, they always want to blame the weights, the coach, whatever it is. And they are to blame sometimes, but you mentioned a great point. Like, if I switched real, like, elevated squat to Bulgarian split squat, I would have kids like, dude, what are you talking about? Like, what are we doing? What is that? Like, am I speaking another language when I squat? Like, what do you want me doing? Like, I don't understand. It would be a mess.
It's the same thing. You know, it's the same exact thing. You know, it just depends on how you want. And I guarantee you, if we both looked at my program, Daniel's program and your program, they would look very similar with different languages, but we would know how to decipher it. You put that in front of a sport coach, they go, wow, you guys' philosophies are so different. And we'd say, actually, no, they're actually really similar.
Yeah, some of the exercises are maybe different, but like, we're all basing it off of, like, you know, we're going to program in however we're going to program, whether it's linear, block style, or conjugate. You know, we're all going to have some type of speed work in there. We're going to have some type of, you know, strength work in there, but one of us may use a back squat. One of us may use a front squat. One of us may say, all right, the guys aren't going to squat. You know, they're going to drag or push heavy sleds. Like, we're all going to have basis of movement patterns in the programming. You know, more max, and to use some West Side language as a conjugate guy that I am, some max effort work, some dynamic effort work. It's all going to be there, but it's going to be, you know, what car did we drive to get to that destination? You might drive a Lexus. I might drive an Audi, and Dan might drive a Mercedes. They're all nice luxury vehicles, but they have different little tweaks to each of them that suit the driver better, or the passengers, so to speak. Like it depends.
Absolutely. It depends. Yeah. And what works for my athletes might not work for Cody's athletes.
Yeah.
You know, vice versa. I mean, the underlying principles are the same, but every population of kids are unique, and we got to adjust our programs based on that too.
I mean, some people might look at Jerry's program and say like, oh man, look at all the contrast work he does. You know, they do some really cool plyos and they push a heavy sled. And then they look at my program and go, well, welcome. You don't do all that really cool, fancy stuff. And I'm like, yeah. Well, you got to understand, I've got 36 kids in here. I've only got a 10-yard, and I only got a 5-yard wide turf strip that's 20 yards wide. I only have one sled. I don't have room for that. I work with 36 to 45 kids at a time. It's not, you know, my parameters are different. You know, yeah. If I had the capability to do those things, would I? Absolutely. But our niche and our situation and our circumstances are so different.
Yes.
But we're still training the same qualities based off whatever circumstances we have.
Yeah. In the same week, you might see me tweet. Like I tweeted last night a video of, you know, 13-year-olds doing extensive box jumps to, you know, nail mechanics. And earlier in the day, I had a 23-year-old doing, you know, overcoming isometric trap bar deadlift holds into a sprint. So it's people, I tell people all the time, like, don't, you know, I get a lot of people that DM me like, oh, I love that thing that you did or whatever it was. I'm like, yeah, like you're seeing an exercise, because I'm not going to just sit here and write 30 paragraphs about like what went before that or what went into it. But like, think of more than just a variation, like try to find out why I did it or what was behind it programming wise. And you're going to be a better coach. If you're a coach listening to this, or a coach that has DM'd me, DM'd Dan, Cody, we all get them, you know, asking for advice or help. Like that is the biggest thing I would say. And, you know, you guys can have your opinion on this, but what is the philosophy behind it? Like, why is it being done, and what was done before it, and what's going to be done after it is going to get you a lot further than that specific exercise that you saw in 1 minute of one training video.
Yep, absolutely. I think it's funny. If you guys follow Brett Bartholomew on Instagram,
yep,
the dude will put out an exercise and then put out like three paragraphs of what he calls a disclaimer of, no, that's not what this means. Yes, that's what this means. Yeah. Yes, I'm doing this because it, like, I think that's super comical. But yes, you need to absolutely understand context, because so many people are attracted to the new shiny thing. I have to deal with parents all the time. Like, I hear it all the time with kids, like, hey, coach, how come we're not training with a Vertimax? And I'm like, well, I train 36 kids. You guys want to buy me 10 Vertimaxes? Because I promise you, you don't want to pay that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I mean, or it's what do you mean?
Like, you can't even, you know, I don't want to get caught up in saying that, like, they're, you know, mastering a. Like if you were to look at speed as a whole, I'm like, okay, I got to get this guy faster. Well, you know, maybe the 19 or 20-year-old or even the 15-year-old athlete that's been training for a little bit and has their movement patterns down and, you know, is moving properly, they're bracing properly and all those type of things, they might need that more complicated variation that you saw on Twitter or Instagram, but your son or daughter doesn't.
Yep, that's a tough conversation to have. And I have to, you know, I almost feel like I have to take the mindset of a nurse and have bedside manner with these parents, you know, because like
you can't be too blunt or too. Yeah, you have to understand where they're coming from.
Yeah, they don't know what they don't know. And it's the same way with having to talk to sport coaches, like how well. That's what I love about strength coaches, because nobody knows how to speak our language, not even administrators at the college level. Like when you're talking to your AD, like he has no idea how to evaluate you because he doesn't know what makes you good or bad. Right. And then you have, you know, you have to be able to be very good at language for coaches and parents and understand how to get your point across without being too brash or any of that. Cause I've seen a lot of young coaches, me myself, that get super frustrated over things like that. But you got to be able to find a way to communicate and even try to replicate their culture. Cause I mean, I'm sure Dan, like the two coaches you work for track and field and women's basketball, I guarantee you their coaching styles aren't the same. I guarantee you their cultures aren't the same. You have to find a way to replicate both of those cultures in the weight room. Am I right?
Yeah, but you know, I've been super fortunate working with them. So I volunteered actually with the track and field team the last 2 years. This is the first year I've actually gotten paid to do anything with them. And this year, the basketball coach actually approached me and asked if I would help out. And they basically just say, you know what you're doing, you do your thing, and we'll do our practice. Like the basketball coach is even letting me handle 90% of the conditioning, which is super cool. which a lot of strength coaches don't get that opportunity. So I'm super thankful that they let me do my job and trust me enough because, you know, the last 2 years of the track team, they've had really good success. We've had really good athletes, but more importantly, hardly anybody's been hurt in track. So, you know, awesome. I've slowly built up that trust where, you know, they don't have to, you know, watch me and what I do or question everything, which is really nice. But I know that's not the case in a lot of situations.
Right. I feel that. Like, I had a softball coach when I was down at a university that I was coaching at, and they're like, "Coach, we need to do, like, we need to raise the boxes on our box jumps." It's like, why? Because it drives intent. They have to actually give way more effort to get up there. And I had to find a way to explain, like, well, what's the return on investment if their landing mechanics are horrible, or if it's really just a test?
What's the displacement of their hips when they're jumping? Like, are they actually getting that high? And you're saying, oh, it drives intent. I think it just drives them to tuck their knees into their chest a little more.
That's right. I mean, honestly, you're trying to drive it out of fear, which means don't bang my shins on the box.
Yeah.
That's not intent. That's fear. You know what I mean?
That's actually a really good – that I mean, I wasn't even thinking of bringing that up, but like you mentioned, you know, the mistakes we made. And I used to be a guy that would chase box jump height. Like, oh, like we did 30 inches, you know, last month. We have to go 34. I don't think I have anybody jump over a 32-inch box anymore. I have kids that vertical jump 32 inches and they'll jump to a 32-inch box.
Yeah, so I chase box jump numbers for myself because I think it's fun to see how high I can jump.
Oh, I'll do a lot of crazy stuff for myself, but I would never do it for somebody else.
I don't think I even program higher than 18 inches for a lot of my box jump stuff.
Yep.
For the most part.
I don't even have boxes, so we don't do box jumps. You know, we do straight vertical jumps and work on landing. You know, I have some jump mats, which is really cool, but that's what drives intent for me. You know, like, that's what's really cool. Like, I heard Mike Boyle talk about it, heard Tony Hall, I even heard Jerry talk about it. Like, you put a timer on a kid, you put a jump mat in front of a kid, I think intent takes care of itself because they're all of a sudden going to get really competitive.
Yeah. Even just like telling a kid what he got in a sprint time versus the other guy. If you want to make sure that your guys are running hard every time and, you know, putting the max intent into a sprint, like a couple different tricks I've used is putting this cone a little further than if you want to, you know, run them 10 yards, make it 11 because you know they're going to pull up about a yard short. Things like, you know, you mentioned about the boxes, something I've had a lot of success with the guys and the girls that I train are cueing them to, you know, treat the box as a landing pad and to jump as high as they can over it and then land down to it. I think the integrity of the jumping mechanics, you know, and the fluidity of it, just you get a lot more out of that versus, you know, having someone try to tuck their knees in to reach a certain height. So I've definitely changed my outlook on that in the past like year and a half.
Yeah, that's just the growth of our how we are as coaches. I mean, I would consider us.
We're very young coaches, all three of us.
We're young. Yeah, yes. That's what I would say. We're pretty young and we're getting there. We're moving very rapidly in our progression. And I think the further we go, we're going to continue to drive towards that goal of just how are our athletes doing in the sport that they love? And do we keep them healthy? You know, like, we're going to get really freaking good at it, I think, especially watching you two guys work. I definitely believe that.
For sure. I just like you. I keep this, the point you brought up before that I just want to, I keep reiterating, but like, is what we're doing getting whoever we're training, you know, better at what they need to get better at, right? You know, if I have a hockey guy and I speak a lot about hockey because I train a lot of hockey players, but you know, if they're, you know, 2 years ago, I would look at, hey, where'd your front squat go? Well, if that went up and their skating times or they're slower skaters or not getting any faster in that sense, what good is that for me, right?
Yeah, you're training the wrong sport.
Yeah, it's like maybe I'm going to, you know, do more of like what Dan said. He has like, you know, a woman who is a power lifter or is chasing those numbers. That's important for her and he needs to get her better at that. Whereas, you know, one of his, you know, female basketball players, that might not help their vertical. What's going to help them jump higher?
Right. I think that's a great point. You know, one of the things I've had to move away from is I used to really be a big believer in that if you work hard in the weight room, it helps you win games. And I'm like, no, it doesn't. You know, I hate to say that, but it doesn't, because you still have to go win the game and you still have to have the tactical and technical and strategical skills. You have to have the scheme. You have to have the actual skill of the game to win. We're just preparing the engine, right? It's like a lot of people talk about, hey, I got a really fast and powerful car, but if it sits in my garage all day, it ain't winning any races. You still got to have a driver that can really go out there and execute the race, right? So we're preparing and keeping giving our kids an opportunity to win, right? But like, going in the weight room and training hard doesn't guarantee your success on the field. I think that it's a prerequisite, but I don't think it guarantees it. That was my big problem as a college pitcher. I was like, I'm going to out-train everybody in the weight room And that's going to translate to W's on the mound. First off, wins for a pitcher is a stupid stat anyway. yeah. So I had to learn that the hard way because I was like, I want to win 10 games this year. And I was like, I have 12 starts. Yeah, that's probably not going to happen, buddy. But
right. Well, and look at Felix Hernandez when he won the Cy Young. He had a terrible record, but he was such a good pitcher. You know, it didn't matter. It was
13 and 12. And it was like, what was everything else? Like, what went into that? And like you said, like, looking at that's a great analogy. Looking at wins for a pitcher would be the same way as like looking at some metrics for an athlete in the weight room that might not transfer or definitely don't transfer over to what they're trying to achieve for their sport.
Yeah. We just got to dive a little deeper, man. Like, and try to get everybody to buy into it. You know, if we just stay on that surface level, that superficial level, like you're talking about, like, we're going to have to talk ourselves into that we're getting kids better instead of having evidence and then showing our athletes, here's our evidence over time, right? This is where you're getting better. And then once they look at it, I mean, they have to deny it and think like, oh, well, or they see the truth and then they start grinding and they start training their tails off and seeing results. And those are the kids you love to see, right? Jerry, you tweet all the time about kids that you're training and all of a sudden just seeing their performance just go out of the roof because they finally found, you know, the training regimen that's actually transferring to their sport.
Yes. Yeah. It's so fun when you like go through the trials and tribulations of weeding this out, weeding that out. Like, you're going 6 months, year, you know, into everything and seeing what works best for them, what doesn't, and finding something that, you know, ultimately clicks for them, you know, getting better at getting to that faster, like making your programming more efficient in a faster manner than you used to. And that's all part of growing as a coach. Dan, I wanted to ask you this question because, you know, seeing that you work with, you know, a lot of basketball players, you know, talking about transferability, you know, when you're approaching getting getting a vertical improvement in a basketball player. I mean, I look at the vertical a lot, which is speed in general, but give an example maybe like of, has there been a time where, you know, maybe a strength movement you've been doing with the lower body, you know, you improve that and it didn't improve, you know, vertical testing if you did vertical testing with those athletes?
Yeah. So I believe the basketball coaches do the vertical testing stuff. So I really haven't done the vertical. Obviously I should be doing the vertical.
Okay.
But you know, slow, heavy squats are probably not going to transfer as much to a vertical jump as we think it does.
Especially with an advanced athlete. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. For a young kid, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old, if you get them stronger, they're going to get faster. They're going to get more explosive regardless. But
that bucket shrinks as they get older. Yeah.
Right. And, you know, so I do measure broad jumps.
Okay.
But I do it more as a central nervous system fatigue kind of thing. So if they come in and their broad jumps are, you know,
like testing, five or seeing six, their readiness basically.
Yeah. So if their broad jump comes in one day and, you know, it's 6 inches lower than it usually is, then I know like something's going on with this kid. We can't push them super hard in the weight room.
Yeah.
But I've, you know, and I admit I've actually been pretty bad at testing and doing a lot of those quantitative metrics in the past.
It's hard. It's not easy to do them. I giving you the benefit of the doubt there. It's tough with a lot of, especially when you have a lot of athletes.
It is, but I do need to be better at doing that also.
Yeah.
And vertical jump is something easy to test, so I should be doing that. But I just haven't yet. So
yeah,
that's one of my downfalls is I neglect to measure things sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, hey, listen, at the end of the day, you know, we obviously all, I could list 50 shortcomings that I have right now. I have people that are like DMing me all the time, like, oh, like, you know, admire your work. I want to learn a lot from you. I'm like, dude, if you think I have it all figured out, then you are really mistaken.
In all honesty, you know, I could really care less about someone's vertical. If they are averaging 15 and 10 on the court, then who cares?
Yeah.
If they're getting more rebounds than they did last year, they're scoring more points, getting more steals or whatever. That's what I really care about. So their performance is really my metric. That's why I really like track and field, because you know if what you're doing is helping them because their times get better. So track and field is super easy. So yeah. I do a lot less testing in that because you know the metrics are right there for track and field at least.
Yeah, for sure. I actually, training baseball players is fun because like it's a sport that's so hell-bent on measuring everything that like it's really hard not to see if your athletes are improving when you train them. You know, wrapping things up a little bit here, kind of moving towards some of the stuff that I wanted to talk about towards the end, you know, of our discussion. We've spent a lot of time early on talking about, you know, transferability and, you know, making sure that what we're doing, you know, with our general physical preparation or GPP is, you know, moving closer towards, you know, the funneling towards what the sport is that we're training, you know, for. I do want to say that disclaimer here, you know, as a person, and I know Cody, you've definitely tweeted this out too. We've been on, you know, the same wavelength here, you know, making sure that people don't have this misconception that you can actually bring sport to the weight room. So after spending 50 minutes basically saying a lot of different times that we try to make our training transferable to sport, I definitely want to break down the wall a little bit here in terms of people thinking you could take sport into the weight room. Let's say right off the bat here, sport specific is sport only, just to kind of get the discussion started on this sense. But what are some of the things you guys have seen in terms of the misconceptions of people thinking they can actually bring sports into the weight room?
I've seen a lot of people bring basketballs into the weight room and hook it up to a Vertimax, or I've seen people hook up a basketball to a triceps push down and like, oh, we're using a basketball.
You know? Wait. Hold on.
Not kidding.
Someone attached a basketball to a triceps push down and I'm going to imagine they grabbed the basketball with their hands and did a tricep push down.
Yeah, I mean, I've even seen a basketball attachment to a Vertimax where like you hold it like in your midsection and jump up like you're going to like get a rebound, you know? Like,
dear God.
I don't know, man. I was just like, yeah, you know, sport specific is very important, but it's sport specific demand, not sports. It shouldn't mimic sports.
Those principles we talked about.
Yeah, I mean, you got to think about what is the body being demanded of, but also you have to be smart enough to know what your athletes are actually doing in game and doing in practice. That's part of their training too. So like, for example, if you're training volleyball girls, I'm a big fan of volleyball. I lived with a national champion volleyball player when I was a GA. He's an unbelievable coach. And I learned a lot from him. He's like, look, if we're jumping 150 to 250 times in practice, we do not need to be doing plyos in our training session. Right. We don't need to be doing that. They get it all the time.
Yeah.
Right. We need to be doing probably more of the strength side, probably the more high force, low velocity, because they're getting so much high velocity in practice. Right. That's sport specific too. Like, we have to understand, like, what are you doing in practice all the time? And how are you going to make sure you don't overtrain that part in the weight room? Not necessarily like, man, I'm tired of seeing things like, you know, the golf attachment or the bat attachment to a cable, and then you're trying to swing and
you could ruin the motion. First of all, I've said this before, and I made a whole article on this. Like, if you don't understand the movement, we're strength coaches, not sport coaches. Like, you shouldn't be putting resistance on something because you could mess it up.
Yeah, I 100% agree. It's a hard battle you have to face, because look, I have dads that come up to me and say, Coach, what do you think about this, huh? And I'm like, I think it's stupid, to be honest. And they're like,
you gotta kind of let them down easily, right? Like,
I do. I have to say, well, let me explain, you know. And then I have to go through my steps of saying, think about what their body is going through. I'm like, man, all I am is just a mechanic in a car shop, man. Like, I don't care how pretty the car is, you know. Like, I don't care about any of that. I care about, is it functioning correctly? What is it doing outside of my shop? And then when it comes in, how do I make sure I get it to the point to where it's ready to go out and perform again? And that's all it is, you know, and keeping our kids healthy, going out and performing at their sport that they love to do. But sport specificity, man, I'll get jacked up and juiced up on this thing if I really start talking about it. Cause, you know, it makes us all mad when we really talk about,
I really apologize for cutting you off, but like, think of the idea that people have this misconception that if the implement that you use in your sport is suddenly introduced into the weight room, that your training is infinitely more sport specific or better than the, you know, other trainer down the road. Like, oh, I'm going to go to this guy. He does, you know, he works on balance while I hold my soccer ball or, you know, stick handle for hockey. I did that with hockey all the time. Like, oh, this, you know, person's wobbling on a balance board while they're doing stick handling. Well, one, if a sport coach, if the hockey coach finds that that's effective in any way, I'm not going to get involved in that because I'm not a hockey coach. But if you're bringing that into the weight room, that's just, it's garbage. It has no place there. And like, I can go in and on about, like, you know, stable surfaces versus unstable surfaces, but like, cause I've talked about that ad nauseum. But it's just like the battle, like, of people thinking you need to have the implement or the tool that you use in sport in the weight room for it to be specific is just ridiculous.
Yeah. Or, you know, I just thought of this, you know, like you said, do the attachments and overloading that weight and all that kind of stuff. It's, people don't think it's ridiculous, but would you practice soccer with a bowling ball? Like, does the heavier weight make you better at soccer? No, yeah. It's not really going to do a whole lot.
I know. It's a good point.
You know, just because it looks like it's transferring, just because it looks like it's your sport, doesn't mean it's your sport.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. And or that it's making you better at it. Yeah.
Right. And sports specific is really just a great way to get clientele, right? Oh, this is volleyball specific sports training. Come train with me. And that's really all it breaks down to. That's what it is.
It's marketing. Yeah.
Gimmick. Yeah.
That marketing scheme, it's hilarious because they're trying to speak that language. We can come back and talk about speak the language to the client's parent or to the client themselves that this is going to transfer to your sport. When really the whole conversation we had at the beginning of this podcast was what we're doing actually is transferring. What you think is transferring is actually hindering. So it's funny, like if you can get really good at speaking the language, because I know a lot of private sector guys. I worked in the private sector for a short amount of time. It wasn't for me because I wasn't very good at this and I had to learn this. Like sometimes you have to tell parents, coaches, administrators what they think they want to hear and then go do it, but not the way you said, like, yeah, we're going to do all kind of volleyball specific. But then when you go strength training,
and you're plyometrics, not, yeah,
speed yep. work, and then they see their volleyball player get better, they're like, oh yeah, they do all kind of volleyball specific because that's because my kid got better. Like sometimes you gotta be a little manipulative.
What they don't know won't hurt them, right?
That's or if right. they walk in, they're like, wait, I thought this was volleyball specific, but that looks a lot like what you're doing with the basketball team or the football team. Well, yeah, sorry. I mean, that's 90% of this, you know, what we program is the same across the board.
Yes.
You know,
the last little 10% is what changes based on sport. Very well said.
If even 10%.
Yes. Well, I look at it even, you know, as a baseball guy, a guy who played baseball and trains a lot of baseball players, like the average person thinks sport specific strength training for baseball is, you know, having a bat attached to a cable and swinging a resistant, you know, heavier bat or a bat with cable resistance on it. Whereas, you know, sports specificity for baseball might be, you know, hitting a, you know, side lunge on a slide board paired with, you know, whatever, you know, med ball throw you're doing. Like that is sport specific and not actually ruining the, you know, sport movement itself. And unfortunately, a lot of people think that, you know, attaching the bat to the cable is more effective.
Yeah. I mean, like, think about hitting in itself. And I tweeted the other day of a kid, poor kid was hitting on a tire, you know, was hitting flips off a tire in a cage. And I was like, this is the dumbest hitting drill of all time. I did it in college camps. I remember in high school going to a college camp and doing that drill. And I look back and go, what in the world are we doing? Like to try and make something harder that's already really hard. Like, dude, hitting is hard. It's one of the hardest things in sport to be successful at. Why are you making it harder by standing on an unstable surface? And I don't want to trigger you, Jerry, because I know you're going to get real mad.
I shouted you out on the last episode, by the way. on that thing about what was it, Kamara on Monday Night Football, and that, like,
yeah, man.
Naturally, all of the ridiculous stuff he did in the offseason was what makes him so good. Obviously, intense sarcasm, by the way, for listeners. It's just insane. It really is, like, you know. The way you guys said it, to put a bow on it, I guess, for the main message of this, but the idea that, like you said, both of you said this, not, you know, thinking that the activity with the sport implement is very sport specific and that the stuff that is very general isn't, it's the opposite mostly.
Yeah. And you know, it was cool about that Alvin Kamara thing. Cause I had a roommate of mine in college who's really big into fitness. Like, He texted me and was like, dude, like, what do you mean balance training doesn't transfer? I think it really does. And I had an opportunity to educate him because we're really close. And I was like, Scotty, man, like, let me explain what this. He was like, oh, dude, that makes way more sense.
Yep.
Like, wow, I didn't realize that, you know, like, why are you trying to balance on something you can't balance on to think you're going to get better at balance? Well, we can talk about that forever. Right. I don't want to dive down that rabbit hole.
Well, and just to touch on that for a second, those guys can do that stuff because they're freak athletes.
Because they're those guys. Yeah.
They're not those guys because they did that stuff. They can do that stuff because they are those guys. And it's never the opposite.
Think about it too. How many of those, think about how many guys that were really good at their sport, played in the NFL, played in the MLB, played in the NBA, and then all of a sudden they become like trainers. And they, like, just because you were a good player doesn't necessarily mean you're a good coach. You know, you may have really good work ethic. You may train your tail off, but you were really good at something, but you don't know why. You know what I mean? I hate to see that for our youth. I see advertisements for guys that are really good, you know, and they, you know, they see things like doing really fancy foot ladder stuff. And like, this is going to make you a better receiver. And then parents believe it because they played in the NFL. Like, man, that's just a – that's such a lose situation, man. Like the kids have no shot, because how are you going to argue that? You know, it's a marketing scheme.
Just like that's tough. I would bet on myself to say I teach a sprint better than, you know, 50% of those out there who have ever run a 4.4 or 40 in their life.
100%. Like, I agree.
Did you study it? Did you like learn why you were running that way, or you were just, you know, really, really gifted? And, you know, God bless you that you are. I wasn't. I mean, I ran well, but I wasn't like that. But, you know,
shoot, not me. I was slow as dirt.
You know, there's a difference. Like, I don't have to be a, you know, an astronaut to know how to build a good rocket, right?
Yeah. I mean, check like Antonio Brown, even though we don't have to go down the route of what he's doing in the, you know, the spotlight he's in, but he spends most of his offseason with Dan Pfaff and Altus. One of the best track sprint coaches ever, right? I mean, he's a legend. He spent his offseason working on top speed.
Yeah, and why does that not get? But why does that not get more publicity than the work he did with the guy that had him wearing, you know, ocular occlusion, whatever they're called, glasses? And do they have their place in, you know, if he was on the field, you know, practicing with his, you know, receivers coach in terms of trying to block his vision? Absolutely, right? But the fact that he's doing them with a physical therapist on a BOSU ball trying to catch colored sticks is really ridiculous.
Yeah.
But like you said, I didn't even know he was doing that type, to be completely honest with you. I'd have no idea, because all you saw on social media all summer was him balancing on BOSU balls.
Well, there's two points to that. One, it's not sexy to work on top end speed, but it's really cool to see that. But two, you know, again, like we talked about with Twitter, that's just a snippet of his programming, right? He actually got really good by doing all that other stuff with elite level, you know, sprint coaches.
Yes.
Which one of the reasons why I've kind of had a falling out with Twitter lately is because there's just so much negativity and attacking of these little things, because we don't understand context. Like, if anybody wants to like talk with me about stuff, DM me and I will go on a phone call with you at any time. You know, when I have time, we can talk in depth on stuff. But I just hate the 240 characters Twitter stuff. I've gotten really kind of sick of it lately.
Yeah, we got to get away from that's why like I'm really harsh. And I've one of my mentors and my pitching coach in college called me one day and said, yo, dude, you might want to back off on being so harsh, because one, you don't know who's looking, you don't know. And I'm like, well, you know, I think I have good intentions, but I think a lot of us bash, we'll be quick to jump on something we actually believe in from our lens, from our paradigm. Our context is bad, but do we know the whole story? We probably don't. So we probably should take some caution on that. I think that's a good point, Daniel, about how we judge people, because you know, a lot of people we talk about, we have the same principles, but that's the easy part. At least it's hard to get there. But whenever you figure out what your circumstances and parameters are, every single university, every single private sector gym, every single, you know, high school has certain parameters, demographics, things that you have to work around to still get the result. That's what makes this cool. That's what makes it an art, is that no matter what you put on me. Like, for example, like when I was an intern at Mississippi State football, we had every shiny object you could think of. Tendos, you know, all the time in the world. You had all the staff in the world. You had room. You had turf. And then I became a GA at Division II West Alabama, where we had crappy barbells and a few bumpers and not even dumbbells. And you still had to get the job done somehow. And at first I was like, well, there's no way I can get the job done. I was like, well, my mentor looked at me at that point and said, you're not a very good coach if you can't get it done here. And that's at that moment when I started to shift my mindset. You know, I was like, nothing changes. Everybody wants to accomplish the same thing. It's just a matter of what circumstances and parameters we have around us.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you said, 240 characters is enough to really understand the entire thought process a coach has sometimes. I mean, there's times where you're going to see something that's absolutely ridiculous that you know right off the bat, you know, isn't, you know, what it needs to be or what it should be. But, you know, the type of person that you definitely don't want to be is the one that literally goes on every single tweet and says, oh, you have a study for this? Yeah, you can you link me a study?
Oh my goodness, stop. I don't even want to look, this is insane.
And like, you know, and you tell me if I'm wrong here, every single one of the people that does this, they'll be like, can I see a study on this? Thanks, ! Like the most condescending, like, I can't wait to prove you wrong because I don't think you have a study for this. Like those type of people really annoy me.
Well, they're probably just really insecure because they can't understand themselves why what you're doing is being effective, right? Because maybe that's not what they do, right? And it makes them feel insecure as a coach that they feel attacked, right? That comes from ego, right? That's all where that comes from, is where when coaches do that. But understand that, you know, a lot of research studies, at least what I see, are very controlled and are not working with athletes for the most part. It's working for mostly general population. And we have to take it with a grain of salt. You know, we have to try and be as pragmatic as possible. You know, you're going to have him on your podcast, but one of my biggest mentors from afar, I'm going to shout him out because I have not actually met him in person, but it's Alan Bishop.
Yep.
Man, that guy, we've talked on the phone. It's funny. We finally talked on the phone for the first time two years ago and found out that we're like from the same hometown, which was wild. I was like, what?
Yeah,
like,
that's cool.
Crazy. But we chopped it up a lot. Yeah, he's unbelievable. And he says the same thing. Like, dude, you got to be a coach and have logic, man. And I'm sure like Dan sees the academic side. You being in an actual, you know, exercise science department, you can probably speak on that just as well because you can see both sides. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean, I am in academia and I do 100% respect the research, but I also understand like, you know, the anecdotal like experience of coaches goes a long ways also. Right. And usually the research validates what the coaches have been doing for a long time anyways. Right. And you know, anybody that, you know, disagrees with like Louis Simmons' effectiveness or something like that, like you don't understand the whole process of lifting because that guy, he's one of the smartest dudes in the world and they're not doing, you know, peer reviewed research at his facility, but you know, they know what they're doing. So there's definitely a blend between the two.
Yeah. I'm not saying this has ever specifically happened that I can like actually recount, but like, if you try to tell me, like if I'm literally seeing my own athletes in my own facility and I have ways and we see it with my own two eyes, that's something I'm doing. It's helping them get better, whatever it is. And I can prove it. I don't care how much research you shove down my throat or try to like, ask me for, you know, studies that prove what I'm doing is right. If I see it working and I can prove it and it's with the athletes that I work with, I don't care what you show me. Like it works for me and I'm making it work. So, you know, maybe, you know, you have to look into a little deeper of the environment and who you're working with and everything. But the people that are always so quick to, you know, ask for studies, you know, and not take any type of merit in the anecdotal, you know, what is working for the person that's working with those athletes is it's a shame because it's a short-sighted approach. And it's, you know, like I said, or like we all said before about programming superficially, it's going to shortchange you in the long run.
Right. And, you know, research does matter. I love doing research.
Oh, it definitely does. Yeah.
It's important too, but
research leads us to a lot of what we do in the beginning. Like it's why we do what we do. Right.
And we can't discredit either side. I mean, we've got to have a marriage of the two.
Yeah, God like, forbid you try to do that. It's not very sexy to people, but being right. In the gray area is usually the way to go.
Well, my buddy Corey Van Wyk at Northwestern here, kind of close to me in Iowa, he's an instructor and strength coach also. He calls it pracademic, right? You got to be practical and academic at the same time. We got to blend the two together.
Yes. Absolutely. Like, you know, I'll give you an example. Some of the you know sled training that I do was literally inspired by a study, but if I saw that it wasn't working – with my athletes, I'm not going to keep doing it. Like it's a little bit of both. It inspired me to use it, but I'm seeing if I should still use it based on what I see with my athletes.
Man, at the end of the day, we use the scientific method, man. It's not that hard, right? We do it over and over and over, right? We come up with something, we test it, we come up with a conclusion. Either our hypothesis was right or it wasn't, right? Or we come up with something new, like, or we found something out that we didn't intend to find out. How many times have scientists done that and found out something else before? Like, it's just like a college coach goes to see a kid and they went to go see this kid. He actually sucked, but the left fielder was really good and they end up signing that guy. Yeah. How many times that happened in our training too? It's the same thing.
Right. And you know, a really good coach uses the scientific method. Just because they didn't make a peer-reviewed study out of it doesn't mean it's not based in scientific principles.
Correct. Good point.
Yeah. I mean, I think Stuart McGill said it best. You referenced him before, you know, I think it was Antonio Brown worked a lot with those guys, but you know, paraphrasing here, you don't need research for logic, right?
Yep. And Stu's another one of the guys that, you know, what he says is kind of the law. He's a brilliant guy also.
Yeah. If he says something, I'm like, all right, I'm gonna go do that. For sure. So kind of coming to a close here, I like to give all my guests, you know, an opportunity to, you know, summarize their final thoughts, leave something that they wanted to say with the listener, whatever it may be. Dan, I'm going to start with you and then Cody, you can kind of finish up, but anything you want to leave the listener with, could be anything we talked about, something we didn't talk about, but anything you want to kind of give them, you know, as a takeaway from the episode.
Yeah. You know, I guess, try not to be cliche, but you know, don't be afraid to screw up, right? You should be able to look back at your programs from 3 years ago and say, what the heck was I doing?
Yeah. You got to laugh a little bit, right?
Like, right. I mean, you got to take your job seriously, but you can't take yourself seriously because if you're so, you know, obsessed about your ego, you're never going to be able to grow and learn new things, right? Yep. And it's okay if you go out and learn something new and it doesn't work or it's not good. Like, that's okay. Like, I'm going to a certification course next month in October, I guess that is next month, all about crawling and that kind of stuff, like nervous system resets called original strength. Maybe I'll get something beneficial, maybe I won't, but I'm not afraid to go try it out, right? So don't be afraid to, Vernon Griffith says, explore the corners. Explore the corners,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you. And the point that I want to make, guys, you know, for you young coaches out there, for any coach really, is get to know who you're training. At the end of the day, we are a service-based profession. We've got to get to know who we're training, who we're serving, understand where they need to go. How are you going to get them in using the vehicle you have? How are you going to get them in the car and take them there, right? What route are you going to take to make sure they're getting where they want to go? Are you serving yourself or are you serving your athlete? And I think that's where most of our problems derive, is with us as people, right? Who are we, right? Are we trying to serve ourselves and try to validate ourselves because we're not confident in who we are as coaches? Or are we really, really involved and really in tune with our athletes and students that we're trying to get better? Because if we do that, then we won't try to make the spotlight completely on us. We won't be 100% married to an exercise that we just love to do in our own training. We won't run them into the ground because, man, I'm trying to make you tougher. Like, that's not going to happen if the mindset and your character is fixed first. I 100% believe that. And if you really try to dig deep, and that takes honesty, guys, the only reason that I know that is because I was that guy, had to look that stupid idiot in the mirror and say, you need to figure it out.
Yeah.
Like, you're not making your athletes better. You're serving yourself. And if it wasn't for a lot of my great friends, great colleagues, and people that I've put myself around to be able to help reveal that to me, there's no way I'd be where I am today. That's the only reason why I don't do one rep maxes anymore, because I realized it wasn't serving them. It was serving me. I was trying to validate that I was a good strength coach. That's not what this is about, guys. Fight your tail off to serve the people that you want to get better, because I promise you, when that kid comes back in 5, 10, 15 years, or if like my ninth grader wants to sign up for my class the next year, nothing feels better. Then I promise you that a one rep squat max going up 30 pounds is not going to match that type of feeling you're going to get when those kids come back and appreciate you as a person.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think, you know, the both of you just that was really well said. You know, one, you know, being okay with, you know, being wrong in the past and getting better, and two, just understanding that what we do is, you know, ultimately for the goals and the betterment of the athlete or the client we're working with. And that, you know, a lot of what I try to get through with this podcast is the idea that we're all trying to get better. And, you know, I'm trying to get better. I get better every time I talk to a guest. I, you know, for sure got better in the last 75 minutes that we just, you know, spoke. You know, so it's a privilege that I get to, you know, speak to really intelligent coaches, athletes, whoever it is, you know, that's on the show. And, you know, I do my best to also, you know, use what I've learned to help the listeners. So I think this is a really great, you know, way to finish things up here. And I want to correct myself on one thing. I don't know if it's because I'm coffee deprived or because I think my Microsoft Word auto corrected this, but I said Stuart McGill and I'm an idiot. And I hope, you know, if he ever somehow listens to this, he's not offended. It's McMillan. I'm a dumb meathead. So,
well, they're both geniuses, so it really doesn't matter.
Yeah. But I was referring to McMillan when I said that, so I wanted to correct myself on that. Cody, go ahead. Hey, what were you going to say?
Yeah, I just want to say one thing, man. Like, you do a great job of listening to us, but man, thank you for having the courage to step out and doing a podcast. I mean, Dan, I know you have your Die Healthier podcast too. I'm going to plug you here as well, but that takes a lot of courage, man, to step out and go reform you guys. I appreciate both of you of trying to promote this profession, for doing what you guys do, man. Thank you so much for bringing on guests and just caring enough about this profession to put in the work. Because, guys, for those of you that don't know about podcasts, man, you have to take time to be consistent, to find guests, to cut up the audio, to cut up everything and post it. That takes work. I just want to shout you out, Jerry. I really appreciate what you're doing, man.
No, that means a lot to me, guys. I really, you know, that makes it all worth it to me. That and like the feedback I get from listeners makes it all, you know, a worthwhile process. So I really want to thank you guys for that and for coming on, you know, spending some time to, you know, help listeners whatever way we can. I really want to thank you guys. I appreciate it.
Hey, and one last thing, Jerry, I just want to say, I appreciate how you've come into this field also, right? I did, you know, I have 2 degrees in exercise science, working on a third related, and you came from a completely different background and you're absolutely tearing it up in the field. So, you know, if you go to school for exercise science, that's cool. If you don't, that's cool too. It doesn't make you a good or bad coach. Like, putting in the work makes you a good coach. And I think you're doing a hell of a job where you're at. So I appreciate you and all that you're doing.
No, thank you. And I do have to definitely say that guys like you who have those backgrounds, being accepting of, you know, guys like me that don't, it really, you know, I'll be honest with you, you know, having some insecurities and being afraid of, you know, being judged for that coming into the field was definitely an issue for me. And, you know, like I said, making connections and friends and peers, you know, guys like you that have those backgrounds, guys like Cody, you know, respected coaches, you know, welcoming me in and kind of taking what I do for what it is and not what my background is, it means a lot to me. So thank you guys as well. I appreciate it. Thank you for listening to another episode of Muscles and Management, brought to you by Challenger Strength. Tune in next week for the newest installment of the show that is changing how we view training, sports performance, and business.